And I think, Edgar, this is right that participants will not show up in the participant list, only the hosts and co-hosts. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So right now they only see us on this side. They won't see anyone else.
Got it. Okay. JR, I think we'll wait just a minute or so.
Yeah, no problem. No problem at all.
Hi, Dilma. Do you want to say hello?
I'll say hello. I'm just here in case there is some emergency that Ellen needs to, attend to or something. And then I can with Edgar, so, continue supporting. But yeah, so and we're so delighted to have your talk.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to meet you. I've heard your name many times. Thank you for your leadership and support of our programs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay, thanks, Ellen. So I will just be in case you need me.
Thank you so much, Doma. Okay, JR, I think we'll go ahead.
Sure.
If folks join a little late, that's fine too. So let's see. I'm delighted to introduce John Ross Rizzo for a Size Distinguished Lecture. It's been a journey getting this one on the calendar. I think we might have been hit by sort of every possible reason for delay, including, I don't even remember now, shutdowns and too many commitments and et cetera. But I've seen a preview of the slides, and I think it's going to be well worth the wait. So John Ross is an associate professor at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine, and also with appointments in multiple engineering departments. I think if I were to tell you all the departments with which he's affiliated, that would take up most of the hour. But it's really an impressive and exciting intersection of engineering, computing, and medicine. And the cyberphysical systems cluster in CNS is the one that suggested JR as a speaker. He's been funded under the Spartan Connected Communities project related to transportation and disability-related unemployment and ways to try to bridge gaps that exist for those with disabilities and transportation. He works across areas that really are at the heart of size, and many parts of size, AI, wearables, HCI, cyberphysical systems. So, JR, we're incredibly happy to have you here. If there are questions, I think you should put them into the Q&A, and then I will curate and read the questions. JR, that works right for well for you.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Okay. Without further ado, please take it away.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Really appreciate you and your team inviting me and also your patience as we got this scheduled. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge everything that we're going through in the biomedical research space and applaud your leadership. We really appreciate your resolve, and we're really looking forward to new strides in our community. So I'd like to start off with an inclusive description. So I'm a legally blind white male with a receding hairline and a sharp 5 o'clock shadow at about 9 a.m. here. Excuse me, 11 a.m. New York time. And I am wearing a purple shirt, a blue blazer, khakis, and some gray loafers. And I'm currently sitting in my administrative office on the east side of New York City, sitting in front of a series of diplomas. So again, so thrilled to be here. The title of this talk is Transformative Assistive Technology, Reimagining Vision Rehabilitation. Okay, it looks like, let's see here. Okay, there we go. And I'm always, I apologize, I'm losing my voice. My son gifted me something yesterday, so I'm going to do my best, but let me know if anything's unclear. And given my visual disability, I will not see the hands being raised, so feel free to shout out at me. It'll be like a Sunday date dinner growing up in the blue collar Italian household that I grew up in. So not a problem at any point in time. And I'm always running out of time. So I love to start off with an inverted thank you. Here are the actual lab members that did the majority of this work. I like to imagine that I'm a conductor over a large team, and this slide is now outdated. Many of these folks are funded through the National Science Foundation in PhD programs at the Tandon School of Engineering. And the ones encapsulated in a red margin or border are the ones that contributed to the research that I'm going to be reviewing today. I'd also be remiss if I did not acknowledge the incredible leadership of both the National Science Foundation. As Ellen mentioned, we were the recipient of an SCC award and some supplements, which were super helpful to launch different aspects of our lab program and helped support different aspects of our portfolio, and also the National Institutes of Health, particularly the National Eye Institute. And I have a couple of the program directors who I have great relationships with, including a few NSF legends. You got David Corman on here. We have Pradeep Fole, Doug Mon, et cetera, et cetera. So I was asked to talk a little bit about sort of my historical trajectory here, and I put this slide together, and we workshopped it a bit for this presentation. So my journey really starts about 35 years ago when I was 10 years old. And if you look at the bottom aspect of this timeline here, this is when I was diagnosed with an X-linked recessive retinal dystrophy called choroideremia. So what is choroideremia? Choroideremia is unfortunately a condition that affects metabolic waste in the back of the eye. You can see some retinal fundoscopic images that I included at the bottom. On the left-hand side is what a typical retina looks like, sort of healthy and pink, well-vascularized. And on the right-hand side is actually a retinal image from probably 15 or 20 years ago. And you can see sometimes people relate this to being similar to a leopard skin appearance, but it's incredibly mottled, very dark, and looks largely dead, unfortunately. And I've had to see through these eyes for the majority of my career, and it's added really invaluable insight in everything we do. I really just want to acknowledge the lived experience as an expertise and how important that is as we drive towards shared goals. So I'll zip through the rest of this timeline really quickly. I went to an all-boys prep school, Don Bosco, graduated top five in my class. I was awarded a scholarship at NYU, and because of my visual disability, really needed to stay closer to home. I finished my training with a BS in honors in neuroscience and a couple of minors, major in neuroscience and a couple of additional minors. And then I was offered an academic package to go to New York Medical College, and I was very keen to start some neuro-ophthalmology research. So really, I've been sort of living and breathing biomedical research for over 25 years at this point. I graduated Alpha Omega Alpha honors at med school. And then I was really at a crossroads. To be honest with you, I really wanted to be an ophthalmologist. That's where my heart was. But my current, at that time, ophthalmologist told me I would be foolish to go into ophthalmology as someone who was already teetering on the edge of legal blindness. So that was a struggle. But I started reading about different specialties and wanted to sort of find out what I could do in the sort of world of specialties within medicine. And I stumbled upon physiatry, or physical medicine rehabilitation, or disability doctors, if you will. And I fell in love. And so I applied to NYU, which is where acute inpatient rehabilitation was started under Howard A. Rusk. Our institution is eponymous with him, and fortunately, I was granted a position there. And so I did all of my graduate medical education at Rusk, finished with the chief year. And then I wasn't really sure. I was at a crossroads again. I was continuing to lose my sight from this progressive condition. But I had a very inspirational chat with my chair, who encouraged me to look towards biomedical research as really a more strong component, or a stronger component, to my career path. Knowing that potentially I'd step back from clinical medicine. That was really the spark that I needed. And about 15 years ago, we started applying for grants, got a couple of initial ones funded, primarily from NIH, and the rest was history. My chair created a faculty position, and I've been here for the last 15 years. The current portfolio is about $30 million in direct monies. And with partners, we have another $20 million or $30 million at this point. But it's been a wild ride. And for the last few years, you know, everything I've learned over that decade and a half or so, I've tried to translate and apply to our immediate environment. And I now have a healthcare leadership role as well, thinking about enterprise accessibility, which was the first time that role was ever appointed. So I'm the inaugural director at the health systems level. Happy to talk about that, take questions on that. I know that was sort of a whirlwind tour, but let's get into the meat and potatoes of the presentation. So we have a very ambitious agenda here. I tried to prepare a smorgasbord of content. I really just wanted to sort of light some fires or spark interest in different areas. So I'm going to rip through this, and if anything is unclear, I'm happy to go back to it. And I will be offering the office hours following this talk. So at a high level, what we're going to be discussing is visual disability, really a primer, talk a little bit about some of the disparities, inequities, and barriers in the disability world. We're going to go into some objective results as it relates to wayfinding. That'll be sort of a central through line in this seminar this morning. Then we'll talk a little bit more about vision rehabilitation, which may be a new term. So I'll define that, provide some examples, and then talk about how assistive technology relates to vision rehab. And then the elephant in the room, we'll talk about artificial intelligence, how that applies to assistive technology. And then we'll talk about some new frontiers in assistive technology R&D within our lab program, and some of what I'd like to call AI accelerants, which I think are really important that the NSF has been supportive of, and I think really positions us more optimally and globally, not just as it relates to blindness and low vision, but really in the chronic illness and disability space. And then we'll end with some concluding remarks. Okay, background. Let's talk a little bit more about visual disability. So it's really impossible for me to overemphasize how profound the functional implications of visual disability truly are. I know what it's like because I see through these masks every day, but in the center of this slide, you'll see a crystal clear view of the building that our lab is currently situated within. And then in each of the outer quadrants, you're going to see the big vision killers in the United States and what it's like to look through their eyes. We've sort of recapitulated the perceptual abnormalities that have created these masks. And imagine trying to walk in to this healthcare facility and to find the security desk and to ask, where you would need to go to, end up at your appointment with Dr. Smith for some hypertension or a new diagnosis of diabetes, and how difficult it would be to find the elevator buttons, and how difficult it would be to navigate the lobby, and then to get into the back of the clinic, et cetera, it continues. We'll talk more about that. I wanted to touch very briefly on the size of the problem because this should really scare everyone in this virtual room. Right now, visual disability is growing exponentially, and it's going from bad to worse. We have about 30 million US adults with vision loss in the United States. And to touch briefly on global estimates, by 2050, we will have over 60 million lives affected with vision loss. And that's at the blind level, almost 500 million with low vision. These numbers should really be very intimidating for us, given what we're seeing as it relates to diabetic retinopathy, age-related macular degeneration, and other conditions. And if we talk about the cost just for a minute, and I know that's a topical area for many, if we look at vision loss and we talk about adding a caregiver, the per capita US cost, both direct and indirect medical expenses, is over $55,000. And I just want to pause on that for a minute. That's over $50,000 per life affected if you're blind and require a caregiver or a home health aide. These are insanely high numbers that are incredibly unsustainable. So, going to zip into some of the disparities, inequities, and barriers that we face as a blind community. Let's talk about employment. Right now, the unemployment rate for the blind community over the last decade has hovered around 60% to 70%. Compare that to a population without disability hovering around 4% in terms of unemployment. Let's talk a little bit about educational attainment. Right now, the blind community, only 15% are attaining a bachelor's degree. This is compared to over 40% for a population without disabilities. Huge, huge differences. And as someone who has lived experience in blindness, I always like to talk about social development because this really holds all things back. The bottom line is that those with blindness and low vision, these kids have less socialization across the board, including lower daily social interactions. And if you look at some empiric data from studies, although we really need more studies in this area, look at the bar graph on the right-hand side comparing, this is daily average of social interactions for someone without sight loss on the right compared to those with low vision or blindness, less than one half of the daily social interactions. So, the bottom line is that unfortunately, social integration is extremely constrained. And it's a little confusing because in this day and age, if we look at leisure activity, and here's some studies anatomizing leisure activity, if we look at the total hours spent in leisure activity, total hours are quite similar, 6.5, 7 hours on a daily basis. But when we break down how you're spending that time, the majority of those without visual disability are engaged in active leisure, team sports, getting outside, participating in events, cultural events, whereas those with blindness and low vision are isolated in what we call passive leisures, as you can see delineated here. So these are big, big problems. And it's not really surprising if we actually look at transportation and think more about transportation barriers, which is really a gateway for all these other social disparities, right? The bottom line is the blind, and particularly blind students, rely on others to provide the majority of their transportation. If you look at the pie chart on the right-hand side and some of these wedge extractions I've done, really 80% want to be transported by others. And if we think about door-to-door car service, that's over half the blind population. So these are really big numbers. And it's no surprising that in the recent health equity report from the World Health Organization focused on persons with disabilities, it was estimated that transportation was more inaccessible and unaffordable for full spectrum disability by a 15-fold margin. So I like to provide a few examples here, but imagine it took you a half an hour to get to work this morning in whatever NSF building you currently work at or currently situated at. Imagine multiplying that by a 15-fold margin or rate of increase. That would be 7.5 hours to get to your current place of work. These numbers are entirely unsustainable, and it's no surprise that we're seeing these numbers in educational attainment and unemployment. And I wanted to provide you some direct experience from my own life. So a couple of weeks ago, I had, and I'm always doing this, but I wanted to take a bunch of photos across my journeys from my apartment to my lab and some of the other hospital journeys I needed in terms of meetings throughout the day and then returning home. And this is just a small smattering, all from one single 24-hour period. You notice most of these photos are taken during the day. I struggle a lot with nyctalopia or night blindness, but look at all of the craziness that I had to deal with on this day. Look at how narrow these paths are with these tree trunks, busting up what are called the expansion joints on this sidewalk. This elevation is about 3 inches. It doesn't really do it justice. Look at this crazy jog in sidewalk around this tree, which is completely against code for the record. But nothing is being done about that. Look at some of these new streeteries and sidewalk sheds in New York with almost no visible path, for me to try to find. Just thinking about different hazards like some of the carrier hand trucks that are just positioned throughout the sidewalk and that create problems. So again, almost total occlusion of the sidewalk here. This is right outside our primary hospital, 550 First Avenue. You got ambulances that are blocking the crosswalk. So I have enough, difficulty trying to place myself in the center of the crosswalk, but then I look up with my limited tunnel vision, and I'm walking right into an ambulance. And here's probably the biggest kicker. I almost stepped into this approximately 10-foot pit that was really only guarded by a thin piece of caution tape. And here's a better perspective, sort of looking into that hole. By the way, there were no construction attendants at that time when I walked past that hazard. So, it's not just me. If we think more about outdoor wayfinding, we're riddled with barriers. I mean, a lot of people say, well, there's lots of technology, but the technology is very prone to errors, particularly in urban environments. There's a very high volume of signage, and a lot of the signage is inaccessible. There are a lot of obstructions and hazards. There are obscure storefronts. I can't tell you how many times I'm going to a new address and I walk right past the address, and GPS is just unhelpful because of the 50 to 100 meter error range within urban canyons. But it's not just about the outdoor environment. So we built this schematic to really better understand and delineate what's involved in both the outdoor environment, so terms you've probably heard, going through the first, middle, and last mile, and how technology may or may not help you in those journeys or sub-journeys, if you will. But then also, if you look into the pink side here, also thinking about the interior indoor environment journey. What we affectionately call the initial meters, middle meters, and final meters. When you first enter the building, when you're sort of navigating through the guts of the building, and then when you're trying to find your final destination. Lots and lots of barriers. And think about the opportunity cost. So we'll talk more about that briefly. Again, I have a lot of material to get through, so I just wanted to pause on some of the additional indoor wayfinding challenges, which do have similarities to the outdoor challenges, including problems with signage, confusing and complicated routing, an insane volume of visual media, including all of these new kiosks and self-checkout, self-registration that we're seeing now in the healthcare space and the shopping experiences across the board. And then additional and different or disparate type of hazards, as you can see visualized here. I can't tell you how many times I've tripped or kicked over wet floor signs or enter here signs, or even now we have these floating hand sanitizer dispensers, which you can see on the image to the right. And again, a lot of technological inconsistencies or errors. If we look at some of the blind data, again, empiric results, up to 90% are not confident in indoor navigation, and about 75% will share that that navigating hospitals are particularly difficult and lead to increased no-show rates and other patient access issues. This is a big problem on our overall healthcare spend from a GDP standpoint. And it's no surprise if we think about indoor disorientation, there are so many problems, right? There are very inconsistent layouts that are hard to remember or hard to build a mental model for, which is really what I depend on when I navigate on a daily basis. You have these wide open atria, which are very hard to navigate through or negotiate. A lot of times, as a blind person, we're taught to shoreline, and I can share what that is. But you basically ride the edge of a room or the edge of an environment, and that's very hard given a lot of the the larger atria in a building entrance like a shopping mall or a hospital. Oftentimes there's too much noise or sometimes too little noise because noise can be helpful and can provide orientation cues. Sometimes environments are entirely too bright. In fact, I always walk around with two different pairs of sunglasses with different gradient tints to help with this. This is something that we noted in a lot of our hospital environments, but unfortunately, a lot of the fluorescent lighting reflects off of these shiny floors that we polish every night and creates a lot of additional visual artifact for those with low vision and creates many, many problems, not just for those with visual disability, but those in the neurodivergent space. And then, you'll walk into these huge hospital atrium, and then there's a lack of help. You have a security guard who doesn't even know how to help you navigate to the doctor you're visiting that day. And then, depending on the crowding, individuals who are also very stressed can create another set of problems for you. So let's look a little bit more closely at wayfinding, and specifically with some objective results. So here's a short lab exercise we did a couple of years ago. So this is indoor navigation, and what we wanted to do, the goal here was to try to find the lab. And we wanted a head-to-head comparison between two new lab members who were naive to this floor plan. So they didn't have any prior experience navigating to our lab or our primary lab at the med school. One of the students had legal blindness and a visual disability. It was a congenital condition. And the other lab member did not have a visual disability. In order to recreate that visual disability, we have a mask over the first-person view coming from the camera. We were using cell phones these days to support journeys and to record this. So this is again a first-person view. And I want to play this recording for a few moments and notice some of the differences on the left-hand side compared to the right, just in terms of I'll play the right one as well. And you could see how much slower the movement is and how much more veering and differences in trajectory there truly are. I'm not going to play this full video, but here is a chaperone-based view of this same exercise. And you could see the lab member on the left versus the lab member on the right. We provided floor plans with current accessibility for the hospital. And on the left-hand side of each of these sort of two panels, if you will, you'll see the unfolding trajectory using ARKit, which is why we had the cell phone. So the bottom line is the individual, this is approximately a three-turn trip that should take you about 30 seconds. In fact, the lab member on the left took exactly 33 seconds, and the overall distance traveled was a little under 30 meters, sort of as the bird flies. On the right-hand side, it took this visually impaired lab member three times as much total time. So it was over 100 seconds and about 2.5 times the total distance, given the inefficiency in the trajectory. So to show that more clearly, here's the full trajectory side by side. For the individual, again, without a visual disability compared to the individual with a disability. And look at these profound differences. Bear in mind, this is only a 30 to, let's say, minute and a half trip. So, what does this mean for a typical day or a typical week? So we'll talk more about that in a few minutes, but this is some new stuff that will be submitted for publication in the next month. We wanted to do some outdoor navigation. So here's a formal exercise that we did with one of our nonprofit partners. We took a dozen blind individuals who frequent this nonprofit for services, and we took four or five healthy controls, or those without visual disability, and we had them navigate from the nonprofit headquarters to the subway or the closest subway station. And then we had them return. So this is a classic first mile, last mile scenario. The total trip was approximately 0.4, or about a half a mile. The round trip was approximately a mile. We had about half of the folks that had central vision loss, like age-related macular degeneration, another half that had peripheral vision loss. Again, you could see these renditions in the upper right-hand corner. And then what we did is we had them navigate through the outdoor built environment to the subway, and we recorded their trajectories and analyzed speed. And interestingly, since these folks had residual vision, we also had them wear portable eye tracking technology. More on that in a few minutes. So I just want to take one half of that trip. So let's say going to the subway, and I want to show you what the time differences and distance differences look like at various checkpoints throughout that half a mile journey. So on the left-hand side, you can see a couple of line graphs and these checkpoints for the population without visual disability compared to those with peripheral vision, and some regression lines that we fit to those checkpoints. And on the right-hand side, you can see the central vision loss. Bottom line, for this 8 or 9 minute trip for someone without sight loss, there was about a 30% increase for those with PVL and about a 20 plus 25% increase for those with CVL. So these are big, big differences. Now, what does this mean? If you look at a typical New Yorker, they commute, their commute one way is about 30 to 35 minutes, and they typically walk between 5 to 7 miles per day. So if we were to extrapolate these findings here into a typical commute and a typical day of walking, you're talking about a 10-minute add-on for your commute in each direction, 20 minutes total. Again, apply that to a commute that increases from a half hour to 1 hour, or to an hour and a half, and then getting those, gains going up to about a half hour for the 1.5 hour trip, right? And then looking at the total differences for an average day being up to 51 minutes. So that's almost an hour of lost productivity for the bad performers here. So this is really something we need to wrap our heads around more, and I think it's directly correlated to the unemployment issue that I mentioned previously. I wanted to pause. This will be another paper that we're going to submit in the next month or two, but I wanted to show you what residual gaze looks like. So I'm someone with residual gaze. 80% of those with legal blindness, in fact, have residual vision. This is sort of a common misconception in this arena. And what we have here are heat maps. So these are the fixational patterns, or a review of fixational activity for those with normal vision. And you can see it classically has this T shape. So you sort of look at obstacles in front of you, and then you sort of look along the horizon for what you can anticipate. And you can see these big distortions for those with peripheral vision loss and for those with central vision loss. Now, if I take each of the individual subjects in these cohorts and I plot the centroid of this fixational pattern here, you could see the differences of activity. So now this was an outdoor navigation exercise where there was quite a bit of street crossing. So if you look at the center of an average frame, so all of the data was collapsed across an average frame, you have the healthy vision, or those without visual disability, getting close to that center and having sort of a pretty tight shape, not too much heterogeneity in these fixational centroids. But if I look at the other conditions, look at how differently they're using residual vision. So this is probably a big opportunity from a training standpoint, and also understanding how to use this information behaviorally from a diagnostic standpoint. Okay, so I know that was rather pessimistic, but I want to be a little more uplifting here. This is a paper from a colleague of mine, good friend Nick Giudice, who's also been funded from the National Science Foundation from 6 or 7 years ago. The bottom line is that navigation can be restored. If you provide the right technology, in this situation, Nick provided this MagNav navigation solution in the Mall of the Americas. And what I want you to see here is that if you compare the sighted with the navigation aid compared to the blind with the navigation aid, there's almost no difference in route completion. So when you do take the time to provide the right technology, you really can get superior performance. And that's the key takeaway here. And if we have time, I'm happy to go back to that paper and talk a little bit more about geomagnetic-based wayfinding. So let me take a step back and talk a little bit more about vision rehabilitation. So I think vision rehabilitation, unfortunately, is vastly under-recognized, but I'm sure everyone in this virtual room is very familiar with what happens in the ophthalmological care process. So really thinking about visual function, the eye as an organ. But there's this beautiful complement of treatment in the rehabilitation domain. And this is appreciating the whole person and really thinking about the functional consequences of that organ level deficit or disease load, if you will. So how can we start to rethink about holistic assessments where we're really blending these treatment modalities? So I like to oftentimes use this schematic that we created for a seminar at the National Eye Institute a few years ago. Bear with me. Let me see if I can bring my cursor into this slide here so I can walk you through it. Apologies. Wait for 1 second. Okay, so what we have here is we have sort of a fun schematic showing the differences between load with these sort of red boulders, if you will. And then we have this idea of functional capacity in this sort of size of the truck. And so what we're trying to say here is that in ophthalmology, you can lighten the load by addressing the pathology. So that's removing some of these red boulders, right? And then, you're going to be able to scale this metaphorical hill. In rehabilitation, we don't do anything different to the load. We're not treating the organ, but we're treating the person. And if we give you a better capacity to manage that load with a larger truck, you can handle more boulders, right? But the sort of the ideal, the optimal treatment paradigm is to blend both. So you reduce both the load and improve management. And that's really how you optimize functional capacity. This unfortunately is under-recognized, and we don't have enough comprehensive vision rehab clinics in the country. So what is vision rehabilitation for those who are unfamiliar? Vision rehabilitation is making the most of residual vision if present, again, 80% of blindness, using novel strategies and technologies to solve for key tasks throughout daily life. We call these activities and instrumental activities of daily living, and then really to think about quality of life. Vision rehabilitation can serve, services can cover myriad activities, including employment, assistive products, different technology, independent living skills, emotional support, and also transportation level and household services. A lot of times there are a lot of assessments done. We can often bucket them into the household level assessments, often into reading and writing, but really thinking about communication. Then there's a lot in the mobility domain, and this is what we've worked on largely. And there's also some work in glare or optimizing residual vision, which we've touched on previously. There are three primary strategies. You may have heard of some of these buzz terms. We can focus on visual compensation, which is really improving function through behaviors and/or visual enhancement technologies. We could focus on vision restoration, which is either repetitive training or stimulation techniques, as you can see visualized on the right-hand side, or thinking about stem cells or neuroprostheses. And then we also have visual substitution, which is thinking more about non-invasive approaches to translate visual media into accessible media through touch, audio, and compound approaches, which we'll talk more about. This last domain is where we spend most of our energy, and we'll talk more about that. What are some of the management options? Again, we're not going to have time to fully appreciate all of these nuances, but there are different magnification techniques, making images larger if you have residual vision. There are tints and different filters you can use. There's both basic and advanced assistive technology. We're going to spend more time talking about that. There's lighting and glare control. There's different telescopic approaches. And then, bread and butter, spectacles and monocles. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about assistive technology from high tech to low tech. So there's a vast technological spectrum or gamut over which this technology is situated. It goes to sort of the low side, thinking about simple, reliable, easy maintenance, sort of very limited. You can think of the white cane in this low tech bucket. Then we have sort of a mid-tiered, mid-tech range. And then we go into a high tech where we think about more integration, more feature sets, more training required, and more electronics. to provide a couple of quick examples in the navigation space from an assistive technology standpoint, I'm sure some of the ones you're familiar with are the white cane or the guide dog, but there are a lot of other technological solutions to help with navigation. If we think about scene exploration, some of you have probably heard of Seeing AI, which is Microsoft's mobile application approach to helping with visual disability, but there are many others. We'll talk more about Seeing AI in a second. I just wanted to provide a small taste in terms of background on vision rehab and assistive technology, but I want to end this sort of background section on this slide, which really highlights the urgency of this problem. So, according to the World Health Organization, globally, 1 billion people need one or more assistive products. And with aging, and this being very disruptive for our demography, greater than 2 billion people will need one plus assistive technology products by 2030. Current day, only 1 in 10 have access to the assistive technology that they need. So it's so important that the NSF continues to support technological development in this domain. The opportunity in front of us is that a lot of advances in artificial intelligence, smartphone capability, cell phone as a gateway, and other hardware cyberphysical system solutions really provide new avenues. So we're going to talk more about that now in the second half of this presentation, thinking a little bit about form factor and embodiment, thinking about functionality integration, and a little bit more about user interaction. So I would be remiss if I did not talk about artificial intelligence. I love to show this slide before we get into how we're leveraging assistive technology. On the left-hand side, you could see a user adoption plot that shows how fast ChatGPT hit 1 million users, which was 5 days, and it compares it to some of the other offerings that I'm sure we're all familiar with. I like to highlight Netflix at the top, which was launched in 1999. I'm sure the majority of folks in this room stream TV content through Netflix. Netflix took 3.5 years to reach 1 million users. So the adoption of this is absolutely astounding. And on the right-hand side, you can see the anticipated market share up to 2030, over $1.5 trillion. Really unbelievable. I'm going to be a bit pessimistic again to start. You know, there are a number of gaps as it relates to the disability community and AI. AI, it's the early days, right? And the bottom line is a lot of what we're using AI for and these new tools extract and deliver too much information. It's too voluminous and too unfocused. And here are some different computer vision tasks that are just really going after everything in that image frame. Instead of really thinking about extracting only the information the end user needs or trying to figure out different ways to filter this information. Sorry about this. I'm getting a warning sign on my slides here. Give me one second. Let me see if I can dismiss this. Okay, hopefully that didn't throw off the slides in any way. So the bottom line is the problem is that the end user needs to select the right tool in the right moment and very often sift through lots of results to find exactly what they want. I would also argue that AI control logic is often too simple. On the left-hand side, you could see different channels that are offered in a lot of the AI-based mobile applications, allowing you to do one thing at a time. But the bottom line is a lot of what those in the disability community want is multimodal operation, or really thinking about multivariate control, turning multiple channels on simultaneously. Why do I want to wait to go through all of this information in series when I can parallelize the feedback? So our solution is really trying to think about making AI more tailored and precise, making it intent aware and context aware. On the bottom of this slide is one of my favorite examples. You could see a blind end user trying to read a menu. In the immediate text box on the right, a typical AI-based OCR approach would just read all of the text. But this individual happens to be a vegetarian. So what if I filtered all of the information and just read the vegetarian options on the menu? Some of what Gen AI is starting to solve for. We're also starting to think about that focus point that I mentioned and higher order control over the assistive technology. So you can think of this as AI systems that are inferring the most relevant information based on prior experience in a similar context, or the user directly inputting preferences into the system that then allows the AI or the neural net to focus that feedback on the most relevant or germane material. There's also some interesting opportunities that I'm hopefully going to have time to talk about. Making AI more integrated and impactful. And this is really thinking about what we do on the back end. And I'll provide some examples in 10 minutes or so on this topic, but really thinking about leveraging stronger computational resources on the edge or in the cloud, and thinking about data transmission and data processing policies. So I'll provide some more concrete examples shortly. So let's talk a little bit about the frontier of assistive technology. And I wanted to highlight a study that we're about to submit for publication. Really looking at the ergonomics of assistive technology and how important form factor truly is. So on the left-hand side, you can see there are sort of three primary buckets or form factors or embodiments for a lot of assistive technologies. There's handheld, there's all these new mobile applications using mobile handsets, there's head-mounted, and then there's work in the body-based space. We've been creating instrumented backpacks and vests, I'll get to that in a few moments, for about 15 years now. And we're trying to think about those different form factors and really thinking about how that supports you functionally, thinking about effectiveness, critically efficiency, also signal and image quality for a lot of these camera-based solutions. And then lastly, the user experience and what's imposed on the end user in order to support operation. So here's a side-by-side comparison of these different form factors and really starting to think about some of the critical elements. Head-mounted and body-mounted are obviously hands-free compared to a handheld approach, which is actually tying up two of your greatest defense mechanisms, particularly for someone who's blind and low vision. We also have to think about motion artifacts secondary to image blur, given the high degrees of freedom of the handheld or the head-based approaches, right? I'm not going to go through all of these, but I encourage everyone to think more about how this fits into existing O&M practices. If you're unfamiliar with that, O&M is basically the physical therapists of the blind community, and also thinking about the movement required in order to operate these devices. I'll talk more to that in a moment. So here's an experiment where we did a head-to-head investigation on form factor. So the software assistive technology was held consistent. We used Seeing AI from Microsoft, available in their API, and we offered it either on a handheld smartphone, an Android-based platform, or the a head-mounted solution, a commercially available headset. You can see this on the right-hand side. This is the ARX headset, which is a company headquartered in London. And we tested Seeing AI with these two form factors across six tasks. We had about a dozen blind folks with profound visual impairment, and the outcome was both to look at functional performance, including task completion time, a participant percentage with task complete, and also number of attempts. And also critically to look at the biomechanics, total movement volume, joint range of motion, and smoothness using a portable motion capture system from XSense. I'm not going to have time to go through all the nuances here, but what did we find at a high level? So now I'm going to compare head-mounted as the sort of the primary intervention here, okay, compared to the handheld approach. So head-mounted is in blue, handheld is in red. You could see each of the six tasks going from left to right across these plots, and then you can look at those three functional domains. The bottom line is that the head-mounted approaches led to a significantly faster total completion time in terms of how much time it took to complete the tasks at hand for a couple of the different tasks. You could see the significant effects with green outlines. And there were sort of equivocal differences in task completion and number of attempts, but maybe a little sort of favoring handheld over head-mounted. But where it starts to get really, oh, I'm getting another warning. Sorry about that. I think this may be a security warning here. Okay, I should be back. When we actually look at the biomechanics, in terms of joint range of motion, the head-mounted had significantly less joint range of motion, which we'll get into this momentarily, has to do with wear and tear and other musculoskeletal implications. But the bottom line is required less joint range of motion compared to the head-mounted approaches. If we look at movement smoothness, there was also a trend towards a significant increase in smoother movements with the head-mounted compared to the handheld. And if we look at working volume, the working volume required, or the sort of area covered with these devices, which was a lot smaller and probably not surprising for the head compared to the hand. So if we collapse across all the tasks and look at global scores, we had some improvements in joint range of motion, particularly the trunk. We had some big changes in terms of working volume. And here's where it gets really interesting for me as a blind guy who's using these technologies every day, perhaps for at least an hour every day. Look at these big decreases in working volume for left and right hand and head, with in the head category, very surprising to us, a 500% difference between handheld and head mounted. And then again, sort of small equivocal changes in smoothness. So what does this all mean? Bottom line, functional performance, you moved a little faster with the head mounted than the handheld. And from a biomechanics standpoint, we saw profound differences in range of motion and movement volume required to complete the task at hand. So this has big implications, particularly from a rehabilitation doctor who talks a lot about musculoskeletal medicine as it relates to compound injury, musculoskeletal wear and tear, strain, and what this means for the body over 10, 20, 30 years of long-term use. And also the opportunity to provide structured training for some of these assistive technologies, which are just not in place right now. So I want to move into really thinking about bridging the point solution divide, and moving into what we like to call multi-point platform technologies. So in this section, I'm going to start off with a problem landscape slide. I'm going to rip through some of this quickly, but I just wanted to provide some additional context. So, excuse me. So the bottom line is assistive technology is often single purpose, is what's called a point solution, and often lacks interoperability with other tools. This is just starting to happen right now in the blind community and with some of the offerings in the marketplace. But the bottom line is there is a huge opportunity to really think about how we can support services, not in isolation, but again, parallelizing these functionalities or feature sets. So our approach to this has been to stand up what we call the Vision Platform, which is a visually impaired smart service system for spatial intel and onboard navigation. And here is what our assistive companion looks like. We have a mobile offering on the upper left-hand side, and I'm sorry, on the lower left-hand side, and an instrumented backpack wearable offering on the upper left-hand side. These are basically sister platforms. A lot of the software-based assistive technologies that we've created work on either approach or work in either approach. In the hands-free wearable on the top, we have a bone conduction headset for audio feedback. We have an instrumented backpack with camera, IMUs, GNSS receivers, and microphones. And then we also have an optional haptic belt or waist strap that provides touch feedback. In the mobile offering, we still use the bone conduction headset, but everything else is integrated into the cell phone. And so what we're then able to do is load ensembles of AI microservices, and we'll talk more about that momentarily. So let's talk a little bit about designing some of the software or these AI services that we would want to integrate into this platform technology. And I'm going to go through a number of key services that we've developed through the SEC funding and some of our convergence acceleration funding. I'm going to pause briefly on wayfinding, then move into travel safety, and lastly, talk a little bit about spatial learning if we have some time. Okay, so let's start off with navigation. Navigation is often not safe or efficient due to inaccessible spaces. Hopefully, I've made that point very clear. Plus, there are a lot of unreliable tools, and we're often left with using 2D floor plans, which often don't support navigation, or if they do, only support navigation in part of the built environment, leaving one to jump from island of accessibility to island of accessibility with huge gaps. There's a pretty big marketplace, but there are a lot of pain points, which I've delineated here. Again, in the interest of time, I'm going to zip through it. Our unique approach has been standing up what we call UNAV for Universal Navigation, which is leveraging cheap 360-degree cameras to create lightweight digital twins. We have a unique georeferencing process I'll talk to you about shortly. And then we have this very cool component where our maps evolve and go through an evolution pipeline. If we have time, I'll highlight that. We only use information already available in the environment. So critically, there's no infrastructure required. No Bluetooth beacons, no Wi-Fi fingerprinting with Wi-Fi modules, no installing of QR codes or unique signage. We only use the available built environment. So how does this work? Again, 10,000-foot view, but basically we go into an environment with a GoPro camera or a regular cell phone, and we take a bunch of footage of that space, and then through a process called photogrammetry, we reconstruct that space in 3D. We create a point cloud. That point cloud then gets registered to a 2D floor plan through a matching process that I'll show you shortly. That's the georeferencing we need, or the analog of what happens in the GPS domain. And then each image is tagged with a 64-digit zip code. This is basically a big vector, and then spatiotopically placed in our map. So we can go back to that if an end user is in that place of interest and wants to query. Send us a query image. So this is how we support localization and navigation. The end user would go into our, this is our hospital you can see on the right-hand side with the query image. takes a photo with his or her cell phone. We then do the same visual feature analysis, create a zip code. We compare it to the database of zip codes we've already created with these special maps that have been registered, and then we can infer your location. Then you tell us where you want to go. That would be the red pin on this floor plan as a target destination, and we use the shortest path planner algorithm, knowing the boundaries on the floor plan to help support you step by step from origin to target destination. You may be saying that sounds cool, JR, but the bottom line is, sorry, another warning here, too many warnings. That sounds too good to be true. Here's a quick look behind the scenes in terms of how we do this registration process, which recapitulates the georeferencing that's provided from satellite with GPS. So here I have an incoming image of a space we're trying to map. I'm using AI to extract visual features. I zoom in and I pick a 3D position for these visual features. This is a GoPro image, or what we call an equirectangular perspective. And then I match that ERP point to the point on the floor plan. After doing that only 5 or 6 times, that takes about 2 minutes. I then infer the transformation matrix, and all of those visual features I've extracted then snap to the floor plan. So everything becomes georeferenced. We also have a really cool process for, sorry, slides got stuck. There we go. Where we can extract the boundaries from the floor plan. And we have this GUI that we created. Each of these little red boxes allows us to edit boundaries. So you could see this is how we support the shortest path planner, getting you from point A to point B. And on the right-hand side, you could see here that we have a destination tool where you can drop different flags. And then that flag is associated with a 2D position in this coordinate frame. And that allows us to support journeys anywhere in that place of interest. Okay. Let's see here. So, what would this look like? Here's a video of one of our engineers walking around the engineering school. Here's the query images coming in from his camera. I'm doing that feature analysis, as I mentioned, and then I'm registering all of those features to the floor plan and inferring his position with this little pin that you can see in the center of that cloud. But you can see how robust this truly is with the amount of matching I'm doing between the incoming cell phone image and the actual floor plan positioning. Here's a quick user journey for a blind end user at one of our nonprofit partners. She takes a photo, I extract the features, compare it to the floor plan, infer her position. I realize where she's at. Here's her origin. She tells me she wants to go to the research director, which is this red flag. She gets her first prompt, walk forward, take the next left in 10 feet. Takes another photo, her cell phone's in a lanyard. We then figure out she's here. She gets her next prompt and then her final prompt with the third photo. The bottom line, providing bite-sized guidance, constant reassurance, again, entirely infrastructure-free. We've done some really fun work, including at the United Nations. This was an invitation to help support some of their accessibility efforts. So we've not only mapped a couple of million square feet, but we've done some of the largest buildings in New York City. Here are some of these maps unfolding. You can see again one of these query code-based registration GIFs on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, you can see the unfolding trajectory in the Secretariat building at UN headquarters in New York City. So let me play a quick demo for you.
Turn left at 8 o'clock direction and
This is
walk
at
into.
Lighthouse Guild, our nonprofit partner. A blind end user is getting instructions using this camera-based approach.
Go straight at 12 o'clock direction and walk 9 meters.
Okay, I think you get the idea. excitingly, and speaking to integration, we're now starting to blend in local path planning. I'll talk more about that momentarily. So let me play one more video.
Approximately 10 to 15 feet ahead.
Anyway, the end user gets to the final destination. So hopefully we can convince you that this works robustly and interestingly is also supporting obstacle negotiation. I just want to check. Ellen, how are we doing on time? Is it okay if I take another maybe 10 minutes?
I think that would be fine. I'm going to tell you there's a question. Let me just ask it to you, and you can decide if you want to save it. You probably do.
Sure. Sure,
And
sure.
the question from Stephanie Gage is about whether there's strategies that we could understand from other countries where there might be better or different types of support for visually impaired. So you just put that in your queue.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's come back to that in the Q&A period if that's okay. Okay, excellent. And I appreciate everyone bearing with me. I'm a little slower today with this voice problem. I just want to plug very briefly and highlight the paper. We did do an extensive technical validation of UNAV in a hospital environment. Bottom line is UNAV was consistent across a diverse floor plan with an average spatial error of only 24 inches and an angular error of about 2 to 3 degrees. This is already better than essentially every market available wayfinding tool at this point. Also, excitingly, although I won't have time to talk to this too much, but speaking to Stephanie's question, we actually have a project funded by the NIH. To deploy and translate this technology in Thailand. We just finished our first clinical trial. We now have mapped a couple million square feet in Thailand outside of Bangkok at a disability college. And what we wanted to do here was compare existing services or what we call passive support. So if a blind student is at that disability college, they have an informed chaperone provide step-by-step guidance to them. But we wanted to juxtapose that with UNAV wayfinding, what we call active support. So the design here was a non-inferiority crossover study with counterbalancing. We enrolled about two dozen blind students. On average, they were between 20 and 30 years old. Again, we did this on the Salaya campus at Mahidol University in Thailand. So they were using our wearable, the vision backpack I showed you before. We also added some additional motion capture technology so we could do more detailed trajectory analyses. And the protocol was students navigate, excuse me, a variety of locations on the Salaya campus using both active and passive conditions. Each trip took place within one floor plan, typically took subjects between 1 to 3 minutes and included 2 to 4 turns per trial. Here's some pictures and some videos from Thailand. This is their engineering school outside of Bangkok. You can see one of the end users. They were wearing a helmet with a GoPro camera so we could do some initial motion capture. And on the right-hand side, you could see some of the Thailand-based topo maps or these specialized maps that we created to support UNAV. And on the top right, you can actually see in green how many of these buildings we've actually mapped, each building representing hundreds of thousands of square feet. what did this clinical trial show? Not only was UNAV not inferior to in-person, chaperone-based instructions, but we were actually significantly better in 9 out of the 10 dependent or outcome variables, which was even better than we anticipated. So not only was navigation success higher with UNAV compared to in-person support, we cut down on total time taken, distance traveled, cut down on wrong turns, improved pathing efficiency comparing to a optimal path. We didn't improve gait speed, which I didn't anticipate because these were users who were naive to the platform and still getting used to it. But in terms of the amount of times folks paused or number of idle periods and idle time, help requested CAID contacts, substantive decreases using UNAV. So this was a resounding success. Other interesting findings when we did an order analysis looking at passive before active support or active before passive support, we actually found that those who were fully blind benefited more from the technology, meaning when you went from the active to passive compared to the passive to active, you got a greater delta when you had that active first to build a stronger mental model. So we had greater deltas in total time saved for those who were fully blind compared to those who had low vision, and also substantive changes in pathing efficiency, which was very exciting. And again, better than we anticipated. So here's sort of a summary. I'm going to rip through this. We're also about to submit a paper as we get this question frequently on qualitative findings. Subjectively, how did the end users feel about this technology? And there are clearly things we need to improve, but the bottom line is there was significant interest, and most participants anticipated success with an approach like this, which was exciting. I wanted to pause very briefly on some of the new work that we're doing. I showed the demo already that highlighted this, but whenever you hear about navigation technology, a comprehensive navigation solution should really provide strong localization, global pathing information, and also local pathing. So we're spending more time blending that in so you're safer on your total journey. So it's not just about getting you the directions to get to a point B or a final destination, but also to make sure that you're safe on each of those trip segments, negotiating around obstacles, knowing when to turn, etc. And that's some of the new work we're doing now. We're also working at navigation at scale across changes in settings. So here you could see navigation at a micro level, at a meso level, and at a macro level. So we define this in the navigation domain, another paper in prep. Micro being single floor plan based travel, meso navigation being in the same building, not changing setting, but going between floor. And then macro navigation actually changing setting, as you can see here, going from one building outside and then back into another one. Most solutions do not provide for any of this, and really only focus on the micro navigation piece, which is to the detriment of the community. And here we have some future directions that I'm really excited about. Some people consider the fact that we don't need physical infrastructure, great, but that we still need digital infrastructure with these maps. And so we're working on new ways to automate the mapping. So here you can see some of my favorite canine friends, Rover 1 and Rover 2. Let me see if these play. So we actually have robots with custom mounts holding our GoPro cameras walking around. This is actually the hospital here at NYU, which is pretty exciting. And we're hoping that that saves on total time required. Let me highlight briefly obstacle negotiation. So obstacle negotiation is a big problem in the blind community. Every environment presents a diverse range of objects, both static and dynamic, each of which requires agile negotiation. Lots of pain points, even with current market offerings. Our solution to this was to spin up what we call virtual whiskers, which is use AI to filter and prioritize hazards, distinguish relevant from irrelevant. I'll provide some examples shortly, and then to leverage high-resolution haptics to provide more intuitive guidance. So what do I mean by that? So we'll jump into virtual whiskers. So I'm going to have to provide some background material quickly. So you could think of us using the vision wearable. We have an input camera, and the output is this feedback belt. So we have these really cool modular units that we've created on the right-hand side. Each one only costs us about $50 to make, and I can get into specifics in terms of the cost of goods. So that's the hardware. Now, what about the signal processing? You could think of this as creating a signal processing approach that allows you to feel your way through space. So this is what we call depth mode, and you're going to avoid the buzzing. So what we do is we take an obstacle detection network, and then we do depth estimation, and then we assess proximity. Then based on how many haptic actuators or how many of these units you've turned on, in this example, I have 5 units. Each unit has 2 actuators. So I discretize the image frame into 10 pixels. And then based on proximity of the object within each of those pixels, if you get to within a certain range, I then turn on the actuator. And then as the object looms, gets closer to you, I play with frequency and duty cycle. So you could think of this as almost projecting virtual whiskers out of your abdomen, depending on how many of these modular units you're wearing. The other mode, instead of feeling your way and moving away from the vibration, is what we call open path mode. This is more of a biomimicry approach that follows what a guide dog would do. So a guide dog doesn't tell you about the obstacles in a room. It just pulls you around the obstacles, sort of bobbing and weaving. And so we created another approach, which is really clever, and I could talk about some of the cool advantages here, where we segmented the floor. Sorry, we detected the floor and then segmented the floor using Nano Owl and Nano Sam. And then we do a traversability analysis with a central tendency. And then we wait where the traversability is highest, and then we push you into that area through buzzing. So it's sort of like Marco Polo, follow the buzzing. We've actually now tested this. This was just accepted for publication. Very positive reviews, looking at both move away from the vibration and move towards the vibration. So we call this depth mode an open path. And we compared it to just using a cane in isolation. We also set this up as a non-inferiority crossover trial with counterbalancing. And we anticipated that open path and depth mode would have superior performance relative to a cane. We tested a dozen blind individuals or participants with severe visual impairment, and we set up a standardized obstacle course. You could see some of the images on the left. We use these sort of foam air-filled pillars in order to create the obstacles. And bottom line is, let me see if I can go through this real quick with my cursor. The cane is always plotted on the left. Here are some scattered line graphs. The bottom line is we were worried about cognitive load, so we wanted to make sure the completion time didn't change. And you can see the two different categories, depth mode versus open path mode in blue and red. So really no imposition to cognitive load, but here's where it gets exciting. Whereas those with canes had to hesitate a lot more. With the open path, there were substantial decreases in hesitation time, and also some decreases with depth mode. But excitingly, what we're also able to do is increase the safety window, meaning the barrier between you and that obstacle that you were trying to negotiate. And we cut down on the total number of cane contacts required when you're bouncing off of the obstacles during the navigation task. So this was also a resounding success. Excitingly, and after some discussions with the FDA, meeting some of their officials in our NIH presentations, they really encouraged us to think more about the diagnostic potential of these advances. And so here, excitingly, we've now taken these same neural nets and we've spun them into a diagnostic direction, not just a therapeutic direction. So what I mean by that is therapeutically, I can help support obstacle navigation in a place of interest, but what if I could also analyze your trajectory during navigation and provide feedback to a clinician? So we have this really cool approach that we spun up called Wall Crawler. I'll play this really quickly, but basically what's happening is here's a end user navigating a hallway. I'm segmenting the floor, creating an anchor edge or a landmark edge along the border between the floor and the wall, and looking at your position relative to that, almost like sort of drawing out your trajectory like a protractor. But look how cool this trajectory is as it unfolds. Now we're able to analyze that and provide that feedback to clinicians. Super excited about that. That paper should be submitted next month. Okay, one add-on. We're very concerned about, again, blending in other approaches. So one of the big areas we talk about with the blind community here in New York City are construction sites and how hazardous they are. So we spun up this really cool new three-layered combinatorial AI approach using YOLO World, YOLO 8 custom trained on scaffolding, and an OCR-based construction sign detection module in order to detect construction sites. I'm not going to have time to get into that, but the bottom line is we just finished testing this. This was just submitted for publication, and we were able to detect construction sites by on average about 25 to 30 feet away, looking at about 7 to 8 diverse construction sites across New York City. All real data, nothing was simulated, and we were also able to detect those construction sites robustly over a 60 by 60, 60 degree on each side cone. Which we were really happy with. I wanted to briefly talk about curb detection, which is another hazard. I'm not going to belabor this point because I realize I'm running out of time. We have a new curb detection module. This basically works, and I'll show you a quick video. We segment the curbs. We then project these safety zones, almost like a proximity sensor on a car bumper and listening to a beeping frequency. But what we've done here uniquely is we use the beeping frequency for curb distance, but we provide either speech or spatial audio for the orientation of the curb. So what does this look like? Let me play this really briefly. So you can hear that beeping, which indicates distance. And then the other tone that you're hearing, which is being played at the same time, is supposed to give you the sense of orientation of that curb. And you could see it change in color as the proximity changes. Hopefully that was self-evident. Let me play one more video that has a sort of more tonal aesthetics. And when I'm talking about tonal aesthetics, I'm talking about pitch. rising and falling, timbre, and all sort of harmonics of the auditory signals. Now you're going to turn and listen to the change in tone. So hopefully that was very evident. We just tested this in a standardized curve detection experiment. Again, non-inferiority crossover trial. This was also a success. I'm not going to get into the data. That was just accepted for publication. I want to briefly highlight some of the gesture-based scene exploration work that we're doing. So this we call point to tell. I'll just show you a little bit of background and a quick video and try to wrap up here in the next few minutes. So basically, we're looking at your hand in the camera view, and we're comparing the proximity of your fingers relative to objects in your immediate environment, hoping that we can focus the AI so you have less feedback that's ultimately more impactful. We started doing this work about 6 or 7 years ago. We did an initial experiment with a shopping exercise, and we found that point to tell was just as accurate when compared to digital exploration. But where it got really exciting is if you look at the bar graph on the right, the total time taken was about 50%. So you're able to cut your task time down by half. So if you can apply that to a shopping exercise, you can imagine how exciting that would be for a blind shopper. Here's some of the new work we're doing. It's getting a lot better. We have a much more robust approach. We just submitted actually point to tell version 2. We have a better model. We're using MediaPipe here for an anatomic
Chair
assessment of the
2.5
hand.
meters.
You can see us almost like
Laptop
spidey sense, but
2.5
you can
meters.
imagine a blind person
Monitor 4
learning a
meters.
room and trying to build
Chair
spatial
4 meters.
cognition and how powerful this could be. So I'll end with some of the other fun work we're doing. And this has to do with actually analyzing more detailed gestures, so hand waves, and then reading descriptions of that
This
environment
image
based
shows
on the
an outdoor park
objects
area with
moving in the
pathways,
direction of the
plants, and
gesture. So if
seating.
you went from left to right,
On the
we're going to
left, a
read
tree and bench
different
for resting,
elements from
clear
the
and
scene
accessible
in that
space.
same order,
Mid left,
which
open
again
paved
helps with
ground.
spatial learning. So one other big point that I want to make, and I won't have time to belabor it, but I'm always happy to come back, is to emphasize the fact that a lot of what we're seeing in computer vision is unfortunately compressed and downsampled significantly. And the reason that's done is everyone wants to be mindful of processing and increase inference time. But one of my sort of core theses recently over the last couple of years, and this has been baked into our NSF grants, and again, we can't thank NSF enough for the support in order to help advance these findings. But the bottom line is that video quality really does matter and is essential to performance. So here, what we're actually doing on the left-hand side, you can see an video stream, image-based video stream come into our wearable. And on the right-hand side, you can see the same video stream with adaptation. So what I mean by that is we're doing packet sniffing, we're assessing the bandwidth, and then we're tooling or transcoding the bit rate of the video to make sure that I get just enough within my available bandwidth. So you think about, I have a data highway of a certain size, and I fully utilize that data highway. Now, hopefully, it's very obvious on the left-hand side, you can see all of this artifact without any adaptation or transcoding. And on the right-hand side, you can see I have this crystal clear image where all the objects are popping and being detected. And this is critical for assistive technologies. So the bottom line is we have to think about the Goldilocks effect as it relates to strategic adaptation or transcoding to make sure that I compress just enough, not too much. Because if I compress too much, you get what happens on the bottom here, which means I'm reducing my image size, cutting down on temporal resolution. And if you could look at the objects in that scene, I'm detecting less total objects. If I overestimate my channel, I also get artifact, and that limits the ability of the neural net to detect what you want. So here's the sort of net-net takeaway. On the left-hand side, you can see poor quality, low resolution, which again, a lot of downsampling, a lot of compression, and most of what we read these days with AI. And on the right-hand side, you can see some of our work trying to highlight and push higher resolution and looking at the differences between the neural nets on the low resolution or the high resolution. Now, at the bottom, you can see object detection applied on those image frames, low res, high res. Look at the differences in the number of objects detected. So the bottom line is not only can you detect more objects with higher resolution image frames, if you could figure out how to transcode them appropriately depending on the network conditions, but you can also see objects into greater distances, and that's built in that paper. So we're now trying to come up with new data policies. So depending on the environment you're within, we could think about fully utilizing that data highway to sort of multiplex services, or to create ensembles of services that can be supported simultaneously. And this also relates to the application architecture. So I'm not going to have time to go through all of this, but the bottom line is the way AI, as it currently stands, especially Gen AI, this applies across the board too as well. When we think about functional performance and we highlight key areas like curbs, spatial reasoning, or food safety, there are big problems here. In the food safety domain, just to highlight this briefly, you could see in the false negative box, or what's critical for sensitivity, some of the performance decrements using foundational models. And what the takeaway here is, if I have a false negative, what's happening is I'm labeling a rotten product fresh, right? And this is critical if I'm asking, ChatGPT 4.0, or I'm using Be My AI, which some of you may have heard about, and I'm trying to assess food safety, that these are big letdowns. So we're trying to think about how we can support new architectures where we're using large language models to our advantage. And part of what we're doing is we're actually tailoring them to blind and low vision use. And so we have some tailored models that we've spun up with some partners. One of them is called VizPercept, which is a blind-focused and tailored multimodal model that we're super excited about. One other quick highlight is that we're also thinking about precision multicasting. So what we mean by this very briefly, and again, I apologize, I'm ripping through all of this content, is rather than thinking about simple broadcasting of video, so you can imagine a blind person leveraging, three of the services I just delineated, rather than sending the same video to all of those services, thinking about how I can adjust or transcode that video based on findings that we've already garnered from some of the experiments. So I can adjust the bit rate of the video that's being, or the substream, if you will, that's being sent to each of these different services. So the bottom line is we can support more, we can coordinate more services, and we can sort of blend in some of what we just discussed. Okay, I have some demos here. I'll save them if we have time. This sort of shows you the synthesis and some of these ensembles working simultaneously. But let me wrap up with some conclusions, because I want to provide some Q&A period for those who have stayed with us this entire time. Visual disabilities have a multitude of effects on functional performance. I think I made that point clear. Assistive technologies are foundational to vision rehab and really do truly improve outcome. AI assistance is shifting from a tool to more of an assistive companion, driven by intelligent top-down control and some of these AI accelerants that I highlighted, including transcoding and thinking about application architecture. We showcased a number of examples from some of the software we've spun up over the last 10 years. And the bottom line is the next generation of AI-boosted platform technologies hold great promise for persons with blindness and low vision, tackling huge social disparities and inequities. So thank you so much for the time. Again, I apologize. I struggled a bit with my voice here, and I'm sort of behind where I typically would be. But I'm happy to answer any questions and go back to any of the slides I covered.
Thank you so much, John.